From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, filling in again this week for your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. A number of listeners have reached out with concern about Welton's absence. He's grateful for those messages as he nurses his wife, Judy, through an illness and is hoping to be back at the microphone next week. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcasts from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible thanks to the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
The Vatican has forbidden blessings to same-sex relationships. In the latest decree approved by the Pope Francis, the Vatican has said that priests cannot bless same-sex unions. The Roman Catholic Church has described such relationships as, quote, not ordered to the Creator's plan. It refers to homosexuality as a choice. The statement also says, and I'm quoting, God does not and cannot bless sin.
Just because a Vatican statement is unsurprising doesn't mean it's not disappointing to a great number of the faithful. On this week's show, we'll get the response of Francis DiBernardo, longtime head of New Ways Ministry, to the church's closing the door to the blessing of same-sex relationships.
I suspect that the real opposition to the movement and the most effective opposition will come out of the evangelical community itself, those people who actually do take seriously the biblical message. You know, there's nothing quite like the righteous anger of people who feel that they've been betrayed because these people are being betrayed.
It's frankly remarkable to open the door to the State of Belief archives. In 15 years, we have broadcast something close to 2,200 interviews. And this week, we'll share another particularly memorable conversation from the first year of this program. But first,
what I think we'll see in the next 20 to 30 years in this country is a rapid decline in faith, first of all, and people saying that they are Christians. I think the second thing we're going to see is that once this tide turns, and it will, that these people will not be in power for a long time to come.
The essential conversation around race and racism in this country has long engaged some of the most insightful and morally oriented thinkers that we have. But it's undeniable that now, at long last, more people are finally listening. And so it is heartening that we are seeing a powerful new book, White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America, emerge at a time such as this. The author is Dr. Anthea Butler, who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and has given us several other important and timely books. Anthea, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been thinking and writing on these issues for such a long time. Why was it that now was the right time for this book?
I think now is the right time because we were at a moment in the nation where the kinds of racial problems and murders and things that were happening had just come to a head. And we haven't really talked about evangelicals' roles in all of that. And so I thought that while everybody was wringing their hands about, well, why are evangelicals involved with Donald Trump? Why are they voting with him? Why are they doing all these things? I thought that it would be helpful to look at a history that points exactly to where we are today and the reasons why they have been supportive of these kinds of racial policies.
You've been clear, and you don't pull any punches, in drawing that bright line from conservative evangelical politicking to racism. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important about the book is what I'm trying to do is show people that the kinds of moral issues that evangelicals have been engaged in, whether they're talking about the family, whether they're talking about the ways in which education should be done, whether they're talking about abortion, these all have racial foundations to them. And a lot of them begin in the 19th century surrounding slavery. And so I thought what would be important for people to see is to see the genesis of that, first of all, to see the ways in which this policy has been deployed throughout history. And then third, to sort of disabuse people of the notion that evangelicals themselves aren't political. They are very political. And they are very political in the ways in which they think about race, racism, morality, and other issues, and how all of these things come together to both protect them, but to also promulgate the policies that they want to see happen in America.
So help our listeners by taking a look back into American history and telling us a little bit about where the origins of this are that you've identified.
Well, I basically start the book in the 19th century to talk about slavery. And while evangelicals have sort of told a story about themselves that they were abolitionists, I talk about the evangelicals who were actually slaveholders and used the Bible to support slavery. And I think that that is an important moment to begin to even understand where we are denominationally in terms of Baptists who split apart, Southern Baptists, American Baptists, Methodists that split apart, Presbyterians that split apart over the issue of slavery, and that we had people who were religious that were slaveholders. I think, you know, it's very hard for people to understand that somebody like George Whitefield owned slaves and used that money to support his missionary activities. That is shocking for some people to find out, but I think it's important to know that and to also see the ways and the manner in which this gets deployed throughout history. If we go past the Civil War into Reconstruction and Redemption, we can start to see where the religion of the lost cause that Charles Reagan Wilson talked about became an important latch point for racism, especially in the South and in the North as well. We think about the ways in which scripture was used to justify Jim Crow, to keep African-Americans from voting, to do all sorts of things that were harmful to the newly freed community of African-Americans in this country, and to deny them the rights that were rightfully theirs. We moved this up into the civil rights movement to begin to see how people like Billy Graham really weren't the, you know, progressives that we might have said that they were, and to the Moral Majority, to Christian Coalition, and to, you know, who I basically call the evangelical president, George W. Bush, who was also, you know, president at a time of deep Islamophobia and ushered in a time of really big racism for evangelicals with the election of Barack Obama. So all of these things, I think, are important in seeing how this arc of history from slavery forward has inflected and infused and supported the kinds of things that evangelicals believed in and also wanted to influence on society.
We do a lot of talking these days about unconscious bias. Would you call this trend something that is unconscious, or was it a deliberate manufacturing of a language of morality and values to justify a more sinister racist agenda?
I think for leaders, it was deliberate. I think that for people, it may be unconscious, but these things have been so much part of parlance that you might think of them as unconscious. But I think actually, you know, I'll be clear that I think part of this is about the ways in which evangelicals have written their history. They have been very careful to write a history of valor, of moral suasion, of all these kinds of things. And I think, you know, we have to start with historians and call them to account about the kinds of histories that they've written about evangelicalism, first of all. And then secondarily, how their, you know, ignorance or ignoring of race has caused us to think that evangelicals perhaps aren't racist, but in fact, they really are. And that's a problem.
You've sort of alluded to this, but will you differentiate between leaders who are benefiting from this very purposeful racism and their followers who may be less aware of the role that race plays in their community?
I think that people get led by their leaders and they have unconscious bias, but they also have ways in which they profit from that unconscious bias. So in other words, if we're talking about, let's say, and I'm going to use them because I think I pick on them a lot in the book because it's easy to, the Southern Baptists. I mean, if you're sitting in a Southern Baptist congregation, you benefit from the racism that happens because your leaders basically say that, oh, we've repented of this, so we have moved on and it's done. And that's without a clear conscious look at the ways in which the denomination has been built up. So for instance, right now, where you have Black Southern Baptist pastors leaving the denomination because of all this talk about critical race theory, when you've had six white Southern Baptist presidents say they don't want to think about critical race theory, well, they could simply just begin to think about their history and think about how their history has been racist and how, despite the fact that they've had numerous racial reconciliation efforts, these racial reconciliation efforts don't manage to keep anybody Black in the denomination because they continue to be racist.
You know, your insight on this is critical because there are conversations that have to happen inside the communities that you're describing. But before they can happen, we have to take into account that even mentioning racism in majority white faith communities triggers a kind of defensiveness that shuts down the hope of any honest look at the situation. What do we do about that?
Well, I think that first of all, what people can do is read this book, because I think it's a good way to see the history that a lot of people don't know. That's first of all. Second, it's a history that is coming from somebody who's not writing from the outside, but used to be an insider. I went to an evangelical seminary. I went to Fuller Seminary. I know how evangelicals think. I've been trained by evangelicals. I respect the movement, but I also have been hurt by the movement. And this is the book, not about that hurt, but about the kinds of ways that we all get hurt by racism. And I think that these denominations need to understand that the kinds of things that they have done wittingly or unwittingly have caused them to be put into this kind of a space. And I think it's worth mentioning here, especially that because I didn't start this book off by dealing with the question that everybody seems to have, which is, why did evangelicals vote for Donald Trump? Why are they so much for Donald Trump? That takes us out of that, you know, charged environment to say, look at this history, and then you will understand why 2016 happened.
So I want to ask you about Fuller Seminary for just a minute. You were there. You were a member of the denominations that are served by Fuller Seminary. Were you conscious of this racism when you were within the community, or were you only able to see it when you stepped outside?
I was conscious of it in the community. And I think the reason why is, I'll be honest, the book is dedicated to two of my mentors that I met at Fuller, one who is deceased, Walter Hollenbaker, and the other, Bill Pinnell, who's a very famous Black evangelical, who wrote about the racism in evangelicalism in the 1960s. And, you know, conversations with him, conversations with professors who were open, things that happened on campus. I came to Fuller right after the Los Angeles uprising or riots, depending on how you want to talk about that, in 1992. So it was a charged time that I entered into seminary. And it was a time in which we were all talking about race because we had to be. We had to be because of what had happened in Los Angeles. And so while Fuller, on the one hand, has been a very progressive evangelical seminary, it has benefited from these kinds of stories that have been told about it by people like George Marsden. And I don't pick on Marsden. I think he's a great, you know, scholar. But I also think that he was a scholar who was blind to race and didn't want to write about that because that was not a concern for him.
So I'd like to get into the ways that you say institutionalized racism benefits conservative evangelical churches that you focus on in the book. Name some of those benefits.
Well, I think the first benefit that it does is it makes it a lot easier for you to meet politicians. So in other words, the ways in which we have lobbying organizations, most people don't understand that Focus on Family, American Family Association, Family Research Council, these are not just organizations that raise money and funds to fight back abortion and to think about schools and everything. They are lobbying organizations. And so they're from the very beginning, they have inroads into Washington, D.C. and other places to promulgate their policies and things that they want to have happen. And so that's really great. Why do we think about Christian schools? This whole story I tell in the book about Bob Jones University and the tax exemption when they, you know, the taking away of their tax exemption when they had to, integrate and they don't want to integrate. We had Christian schools because people didn't want to go to school with Black people. And so you have these, you know, segregation academies that rise up, that a lot of them are Christian schools. We have to think about this in terms of employment. You can, you know, discriminate if you are a Christian school. You don't have to hire somebody who's, you know, gay. You don't have to think about certain kinds of people if they don't fit your parameters. There are ways in which this has permeated our entire governmental structure and the structure of institutions and churches. And so I think it's really important for us to start to think about the ways in which Christians, especially evangelicals, have benefited from that and have been able to carve out these walls around themselves that allow them to be racist, but to claim that they aren't racist because they're not, you know, physically racist, like wearing sheets or something like that.
A lot of institutions and a lot of politicians will look back even 10, 20, 25 years and say things are different now. How do current political leaders benefit from this same kind of systemic racism that you've discussed?
Well, they benefit in lots of different ways, the ways in which their worlds are circumscribed. They benefited by that, by this kinds of structural racism, even in voting and all of these things that I think about, you know, how we talk about gerrymandering and other things. They benefit because people have been there to set up the structures. So if I'm thinking about evangelicals in the way, for instance, that they took over school boards and all this stuff, by the time we get to somebody who's in the Trump administration, who basically rolls back Title IX rules because, you know, basically we don't have to pay attention to the sexuality stuff. Why would we do that? You know, why would Secretary DeVos have to do anything with that? That's part of her evangelical belief. That, you know, perhaps maybe it's women's fault. Maybe we shouldn't think about things like that. Or maybe this is too unseemly and should be dealt with in a different way. We shouldn't hold people responsible for that. And so that's how these ideas get permeated and come into a governmental system, because we have people who wanted to dismantle that structure. If you want a great example of how this has happened, look at the educational system in this country. Look at the ways in which high schools and junior high schools and other things have been gutted by this, we don't want government to be in the middle of the education system, and let's set up charter schools. This was another way to gut the education system and to bring those kinds of racial ideas into the mix, where you don't want to have people mixing. You don't want integration. You don't want those kinds of things. And you can say that ostensibly because it's like, well, I don't want my Christian children to have to deal that way. Same thing with homeschooling. I think if we look at education, someone could have written this book simply about education in America alone and how evangelicals' intervention in education shows the racist structures that they have created and continue to create in order to keep others out.
You know, I've noticed that simply noting that there are disparities and injustices doesn't always prompt people to reflection and change. But are there some communities that are moving away from this kind of power dynamic? And if so, what's motivating them?
Well, I think younger communities of evangelicals are, and I think what's motivating them in part is seeing the, you know, the continual loop of violence against African Americans and others in this country. We just, you know, we're taping this after a huge murder of eight people in Atlanta, including six Asian women. And this kind of AAPI, you know, racism that's happening right now comes directly from historic ideas about, you know, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in missionary accounts from the 19th century. And the ways people get sexualized. I mean, I don't even have to make it a black-white thing. I can go down the list of different groups in America who have been, you know, racialized in certain kinds of ways by Christian groups, ostensibly through, you know, spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ, right? And so I think what we have to really begin to see now is how this is part and parcel of our culture, how this has been weaponized in the last 4 years, especially during the Trump administration. And how are we going to begin to dismantle this so that we can have a more just and fair society?
Beyond some of these individual communities that you've identified and discussed, you write in the book that American evangelicalism writ large needs a reckoning, and it needs it now. What does that reckoning look like?
Well, I actually think the reckoning looks like what I'm trying to do in the book, which is hold the mirror up to them to show them that it's not as beautiful as they think. They are not as beautiful as they think they are. That's the first thing, is to realize that, yes, indeed, despite the fact that you love Jesus very much, you can be racist. And that coming to that grips to that with that is an important factor. That's number one. Number two is to realize why people are walking out of their churches and denominations. I mean, I think the Southern Baptists are a great example, but Methodists and others are all having the same kind of issue, right? And so whether it's about sexuality, whether it's about race, whether it's about young people who don't care about the same things that they cared about anymore, that evangelicals care about anymore, I think it's important for them to see that because of their stances, and especially in the last 4 years, that they've become pariahs. And that not only are they pariahs, but they're pariahs that are responsible for a lot of different things. So let me take one example that's a pretty current one. When Please. We talk about coronavirus, right, and all the churches that wanted to meet and meet unmasked, despite everything, despite science, and not caring. I get why you want to go to church, but there are reasons why for public health that you shouldn't. And people fought tooth and nail against this, saying that this was religious freedom. Well, it's not just about religious freedom for you. It's about protection for the communities. And, you know, what all of this did was make very clear that as far as things go, anything outside of the confines of evangelicalism, they do not care about.
Now, having said all of this, I'm hoping that you have some hope for the future, that there will be more than cosmetic change, that there will be systematic change. Is there something that gives you that hope?
Yeah, younger people, I think. I think that the changes in which how people are talking about their Christianity gives me hope. That's first thing. I think, you know, to quote scripture here, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, therefore it can bring much fruit. I need some of this stuff to die. That's to be honest with you. And I think that it's dying in part because people are realizing that it's not bringing life to them. I think that, you know, even though it's been really hard to watch, you know, the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others, and how some evangelicals have spoken about Black Lives Matter, I think that these social movements are a way in which to call evangelicals to account for their unchristlike behavior towards people, because they believe that they have the truth and nobody else has it. I think what gives me hope also is the fact that, you know, whether this may sound very strange, is that people are leaving. And in the leaving, I have hope because there's a chance to create different kinds of structures and more just structures for people that, you know, encompass in Christianity in one sense, and in another way to think about the kinds of damage that Christianity has done through racism and the use of racism and the cross as a way to put people in strange places. I think that what I'm most hopeful about, and the thing that I'm most hopeful about, is that people who have been oppressed by this, whether they're African-American, Asian-American, Latinos, and other ethnic groups, are starting to realize the pain that being in these kinds of groups has caused them, and they are confronting that in different and various ways.
You are able to bring this message because of your experience as an evangelical, and because you had the training at Fuller Seminary that exposed you to the full range of this. You're speaking, though, to white people as an outspoken Black woman.
Yes, I am.
Are there white leaders within the evangelical community that you look to? I'm not asking you to name anybody, but are there white leaders that you're leading to, that you're looking to be the voice of this kind of necessary transformation?
No, I want to say that very clearly. No, I think, you know, and when I say no, I mean, I'm not looking at white male leaders that way. I mean, honestly, to be quite frank with you, I'm more intrigued with women like Beth Moore, because I think that's a much more powerful place to move from. And she's just left the Southern Baptist. And although she and I would not agree on everything, I think her confrontation of the Southern Baptist men is a good start, because I think that, you know, how we reach people with people who are real. I don't know that denominational leaders are going to pay much attention to this. I'll be honest with you. I mean, they may say that they think I'm in critical race theory or something like that, but I don't, I mean, I got to be honest with you. I don't look to leaders. And I want to be really clear here also, as well, is that, yes, of course, there are some names that you would think that I would say right off the bat. I don't think this is going to come from the leadership we have right now. I'm not sure that they're capable. I think it's going to come from younger people and people who are willing to look at what is in this book, and willing to think about change, and willing to do that on a grassroots level. I don't look at leaders as a way to make change anymore. there's change that could come from the bottom up. And I think that's the place where it needs to come from.
Wow. That's an important message for people to hear, because too often people who are in positions of power will do just enough to keep themselves in power.
Exactly. And I think we've seen from all of this, as I've shown in the book, that these, you know, reconciliations and all this stuff, this is dressing. I need people to do the real work, and real people do real work. Leaders want to think about how they remain in power.
So let's talk about that real work for my last question here. What is it you would like every reader of this book to take away with them after they've read it? And they should.
To think about the ways in which, whether they're Christian or not, that they've bought into the stories they've been told about evangelicalism, and how that has affected their behavior towards others. So in other words, what I mean by that is, how has it been that your acceptance of, you know, all the things that you've been told about law enforcement, all the things that you've been told about prison, all the things you've been told about abortion, all the things you've been told about, you know, segregation, or that civil rights, where now we're all equal, all of those things that you've been told, you need to start to rethink them, because this history makes you have to rethink the history of evangelicalism. And, you know, there can be multiple tracks. There can be multiple ways to think about things. There can be nuance. And I think that for a lot of evangelicals, they've taken this, you know, happy story about themselves and thought that that was the only story that there was. But this is another story. And that story should cause them grief, and it should cause them pause, and it should cause reflection, but it should also cause action.
Dr. Anthea Butler is Associate Professor of Religious Studies and the Graduate Chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her previous books include Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World. Dr. Butler's latest book is White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America, due out March 22nd, 2021, from the University of North Carolina Press. Anthea, thank you so much for what you bring to this essential conversation, and for taking this time to be with us on State of Belief.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Next, we'll get a response to that provocative Vatican statement on God and same-sex relationships from Francis DiBernardo, longtime head of New Ways Ministry. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all at stateofbelief.com. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. While a decree from any religious authority has only limited impact in today's diverse and multicultural world, the statement from the Roman Catholic Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith this week still made plenty of headlines. There can be no church blessing of same-sex relationships. Too confusing, the document said, adding for good measure a quote that has echoed around the globe, "God cannot bless sin." Especially because the Catholic Church has long involved itself in lobbying for government policies that impact millions of non-Catholics in this country, this development deserves our attention. And I'm happy to be joined now by Francis DiBernardo, the longtime executive director of New Ways Ministry. Francis, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What is in this statement from the Vatican that has grabbed so much attention?
Well, I think the biggest thing that has grabbed attention is what you said in your intro, that God can't bless sin. The depiction of lesbian gay relationships as being sin is something that most Catholics and most and many other people have moved past. They recognize that these relationships are divinely inspired and divinely supported because they're based in love. And the Christian scriptures' most basic definition of God is that God is love. So if these relationships are based in love, then they can't be sin. So it just was received like a smack in the face or a punch in the stomach to many LGBTQ Catholics and to the people that support them.
What do you think prompted this statement, and who comprises the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith?
Well, the best guess of what prompted it is the fact that in Europe, particularly in Germany and Austria, Catholic priests have begun blessing same-sex couples. With legal marriage, with marriage for lesbian gay people legal in those countries, they have found many couples coming to their parishes, and they see it as wise pastorally to bless them if the couple asks for the blessing. This movement has become so big in Austria and Germany that even bishops are promoting the idea. And in Germany in particular, the Catholic Bishops' Conference is examining ways to provide official blessings for same-sex couples. So I think that this, and then here in the United States, on a much smaller scale, since marriage equality, many pastors have felt that they had to find a way to affirm the gay and lesbian couples who chose to get married legally. They can't get married in church, so blessing their union was an alternative that seemed pastorally helpful. So there's a movement afoot. And I think, you know, the statement from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith was called a response to a dubium. And a dubium is a doubt. It's the Latin word for doubt. And it means that someone, a bishop or a cardinal, sent a doubt to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And in this case, the doubt was a question. Does the church have the authority to bless same-sex union? And the answer that was given on Monday was that the congregation doesn't feel it has that authority, that the church doesn't have that authority.
Who is the congregation of the congregation that we're talking about?
Right. The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith is sometimes considered the most important department in the Vatican, because it is the office in the Vatican that is charged with what's called the deposit of faith. And basically what that means is the Church's teaching. What are authentic Catholic teachings? And what does the Catholic Church teach authentically? It is known, it used to be known as the Holy Office of the Inquisition. And their methods were a little more grisly in the old days. But in modern times, their methods, that they are bishops, cardinals, priests, and theologians who evaluate different situations that come up in light of the church's beliefs, and then articulate them in statements or decisions.
As I understand it, the statement that came out has the blessing of Pope Francis. He has seemed open to LGBTQI plus persons. Is that the reason this statement came as a surprise to some people?
Yes. Pope Francis has made incredible strides for the church on being more open to and aware of and sensitive to the needs of LGBTQ people. And so it was a surprise, particularly because although Pope Francis has not called for a change in church teaching, what he has done is he has emphasized a more pastoral approach. He's been telling church pastors to be more sensitive and to accompany LGBTQ people pastorally, meaning don't start with doctrine, you know, start with getting to know the person and getting to know what their life situation is like and trying to find where God intervenes in those lives and help the people realize that. So he has specifically stayed away from harmful language about LGBTQ missions. So, you know, the statement that, you know, that these relationships are thin is something very, very uncharacteristic of the way Pope Francis has acted over the last 8 years.
You've written that this step will actually encourage many supporters of same-sex couples. Can you talk about why that seems to be the opposite of what we might think?
Right. I wrote that on Monday as a prediction when the document came out. And what I have seen is that I'm a pretty good prognosticator because in Austria, a group of priests signed a document saying we will continue to bless same-sex unions. A bishop in Germany and a bishop in Belgium came out with statements criticizing this gift. Just yesterday, 1,000 pastoral ministers in Germany have signed a declaration that they will continue to bless same-gender couples. Just today, my organization, New Ways Ministry, has launched a campaign to collect signatures of pastoral ministers here in the United States and abroad, saying that as Catholics, we don't accept this statement and we will continue to bless and affirm LGBT. So it has really been a tidal wave, and those are the highlights. There have also been numerous statements from Catholic organizations on the grassroots level condemning the Vatican decision.
Will it have weight in the conversations within the church and the Catholic community?
Yes, it will have some weight in that if enough members of the hierarchy or people in higher positions make some dissent and critique. You know, particularly, I hate to say it, but it's been noted already this week that, you know, the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, would be very leery of any dissent coming from Germany, where Martin Luther got his start. You know that, and that's where the dissent seems to be the strongest right now. So
the Church has a long memory in Germany, I guess.
Yes. So I think that the Vatican is going to take very seriously what some of these bishops say, because they have to. They have to preserve church. And actually, the way I think this whole situation is going to resolve itself is I believe that Pope Francis is going to, this is another prognostication for me, we'll see how it turns out, but I think he's going to do something very positive, make some sort of very positive statement or gesture.
Well, you heard it first on State of Belief Radio. So, Francis, we've talked about hierarchy and structure and policies and politics. Can you talk about the personal toll this kind of statement takes on you and the people whom you serve?
It has been devastating. I can't tell you how many emails and phone calls I've fielded this week from people who are leaving the church, who are confused, who are terribly had their faith shaken terribly. It's been really, really sad. Letters, emails, messages from parents of LGBTQ people who just don't see the logic of how their church is acting towards their children. I've spoken with campus ministers who on college campuses who say that the students there, the Catholic students there, and the LGBTQ students who aren't Catholic, are in an uproar. I think particularly in the younger generation where support for LGBTQ issues is much, much stronger than in older generations, I think this statement is going to cause incredible pastoral harm.
Francis, for listeners who may not be familiar with your work, what is New Ways Ministry and how can people engage with you?
Sure. New Ways Ministry is a national Catholic ministry of justice and reconciliation between the LGBTQ community and the Catholic Church. We were founded in 1977. We're 44 years old. By a visionary priest and nun, Sister Jeanine Gramick and Father Robert Nugent, who had been ministering with the lesbian gay community for 6 years previous. And they saw that the biggest problem around the issue of homosexuality at the time was not the lesbian gay people. They weren't the problem. It was the ignorance of other people in the church about lesbian gay reality. And at the time, it was just lesbian gay. There was little awareness of bisexuality or transgender people. So they established New Ways Ministry primarily to be an educational center to help educate church leaders and people in the pews about the reality of the lives of LGBT people, and also about the positive developments that were happening in church teaching during the 70s and 80s around LGBT issues. During that time, there was a lot more interest from church hierarchs about developing Catholic doctrine and becoming a more accepting church. We saw the brakes put on during the papacies of John Paul II and Benedict XVI, but now it's becoming revived again. So the idea was to educate. And that through education, better understanding would happen. And it was also to advocate. As we say, we try to be a Catholic voice in the LGBTQ community, and we try to be an LGBTQ voice in the Catholic.
I'm glad that you mentioned Sister Jeanine. She was a guest on this show with our regular host, Welton Gaddy, in 2014, and it is a conversation well worth listening to. Our listeners can find it at stateofbelief.com in the archives. So I'm glad you brought up her role in all of this. How can our listeners find out more about New Ways Ministry?
They could go to www.newwaysministry.org and find out about all our programs and resources.
Francis, I thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio today.
Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity.
As we mark the 15th anniversary of our show, let's dive into the archives for a particularly unforgettable interview from our first years on the air.
A war correspondent for the New York Times for nearly two decades, serving in Central America, Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans, Chris Hedges is the author of the widely acclaimed War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and more recently, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. He's also the son of a Presbyterian minister and a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. Chris Hedges, thanks so much for joining me on State of Belief.
Thank you.
You're working on a book right now, I understand, about the religious right. And I know you've spent a lot of time studying right-wing religious broadcasting. How has right-wing religious broadcasting gotten so strong, and what do we need to do to combat it?
Well, let me back up just a little bit and first say that I think this is a political movement very similar to the kinds of movements that I covered in the Balkans, where rabid nationalists who preached an ideology of hatred and exclusion and violence wrapped themselves in patriotic symbols and religious symbols, used patriotic and religious language to further a cause that is really about the destruction of the open society. That doesn't mean that many of the millions of people in this country who have been disenfranchised, who don't have health insurance, who don't have a prospect of getting a decent job with a living wage and a good education for their children, haven't been sucked into this movement. I think this is born out of a culture of despair. But nevertheless, those who are directing the movement, who I think are cynical and manipulative, and let's not forget have become fabulously wealthy, are using this despair and this dislocation, and this is a, you know, remember the Democratic Party had walked out on the working class in this country about two decades ago, to build a movement that has far more in common with the intolerant and totalitarian movements that I covered in Eastern Europe and in parts of the Middle East, and that's certainly my take on the movement. So when you watch closely the broadcasting, I spend weekends at, you know, pro-life conferences, and I went to a conference recently in Missouri where they were teaching Christian school teachers how to teach creationism, this kind of stuff. It is really fear-based. You know, when they send people out to convert, it's all about fear. The first question they ask is, if you die tomorrow, will you go to heaven? And the second question they ask is, you know, standing at the gates of heaven, can you say to God that you've led a good and Christian life? You know, will you, what can you say to be allowed in? If you look at characters like Pat Robertson or Benny Hinn, they run small little third world dictatorships. You know, they're surrounded by bodyguards. They won't go anywhere near the mainstream media. They've created their own parallel information system, quite effective, that is about indoctrination. And I think one of my frustrations within coming back to the United States after almost two decades away is the complacency and the apathy, not only on the part of most Americans, who I think don't have any desire to live in a country like this, but among religious leaders who should know better.
Chris, it seems to me your description is so accurate, and it seems to me implicit in that is the imperative that the response to the religious right ought not come just from the so-called left in America, but should come from the middle and even from classic conservatives, because we're talking about a major change in the nature of our nation if that point of view prevails.
I suspect that the real opposition to the movement and the most effective opposition will come out of the evangelical community itself. Those people who actually do take seriously the biblical message. You know, there's nothing quite like the righteous anger of people who feel that they've been betrayed because these people are being betrayed.
Let me pick up on that just a second and apply it to one specific area. You have said in the past that what's happening in Ohio is a blueprint for a theocratic takeover of our nation.
Well, Ohio is one of the states that the Christian right has targeted, and there are a couple groups, Restoration Ohio. I attended a rally by a group called Patriot Pastors that I think, other than having, you know, guys in crew cuts and brown shirts, could legitimately be called a fascist movement. Their symbol is the Christian cross superimposed on the American flag. They were had a choir dressed in red, white, and blue and were singing religious and patriotic songs while they showed pictures of the war in Iraq. You know, if you go on Ken Blackwell's, he's the Secretary of State, and look on his website, their central platform is making Ohio a state of character. But of course, when you read it through, character is narrowly defined by their good, their version of Christianity, and all who do not conform to that have no place within the system. Evangelical groups have bought onto this, and Ohio, of course, is a key state in large part because of the flight of manufacturing jobs and the terrible price that Ohio has paid in terms of its economy and in terms of the struggle the working class has had there. Never forget that Ohio has more registered hate groups than any other state in this nation. And again, what they're doing is manipulating and playing on this despair, this rage that people feel at having been dispossessed. And I think that that emotion is legitimate. They have been dispossessed.
Among Christians, why do evangelicals, who tend to be biblical literalists, so avidly support war when Jesus taught and blessed peacemaking? Is that support rooted in religion or is it rooted in politics?
It's probably rooted in something much more primal than that, and that is a thirst for empowerment. You know, when you look at the Christian right, this mass movement that is seeking to take control of our political process and our governmental institutions, it is all about power and vengeance and violence. I mean, the final aesthetic of any totalitarian movement is violence. And you see it in the End Times series. You see it in the images of Christ the warrior. It's, of course, a complete perversion. I mean, Jesus was clearly, I'm not a pacifist, but Jesus was clearly a pacifist. I don't know how you can read the four Gospels any other way. I think that it is something that plays to the darker elements within human nature. You know, as H. Richard Niebuhr said, religion is a good thing for good people and a bad thing for bad people. And we have a lot of bad people.
I saw a story, I think it was in the Boston Globe, that suggested that perhaps the religious right movement is on the wane in this nation. Do you see that?
No, it's not on the wane. It's not a reality-based movement. That's the important thing to remember. That's why creationism is so dangerous. What you do when you want to create a totalitarian movement, the first thing you do is disconnect the masses from reality. And that's what this is about. And you see in these irrational attempts to hold together this ideology, which is really about magic, how impervious they are to normal, thoughtful argument. I don't think it's on the way.
My guest has been Chris Hedges, author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and more recently, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. I hope you know that. We are grateful when you make gifts. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.